I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. It was back in the year 1986. I was making my way through Checkpoint Charlie from West Berlin to East for a day visit. The Berlin Wall still intact. The guards there held automatic weapons, search dogs on short leashes. It pretty much creeped me out. East Berlin was then, of course, the Soviet footprint. This was back in the day when all of Berlin was still divided, and you could see which sectors of the city had been occupied at one time by the Americans, the French, the British. There was still that Soviet sector. We didn't call it that. We just called it East Berlin. Well, this is a place where there had been and was, when I visited, a grand impasse still in place, a place that was frozen into surreal stasis by the Cold War. This kind of thing happens far too often in history in cities, in Berlin, in Jerusalem, Belfast, Nicosia, with a drama that is not always visible. These kinds of places are filled with incredible tension. Perpetually, it seems that they are on the brink, ready to snap. Well, just 3 years after my visit to East Berlin, the wall came down. Those were staggering days of change. Television brought us one dramatic scene after another. You may remember the Soviet Empire was rattled to its very foundations, and the world order underwent what we, who had grown up during the Cold War, thought was never possible in the way of a new governing order. Today we are going to go to Berlin to consider the front end of this story, not the chapter when the wall comes down, but the years right after World War II, when Berlin was occupied, carved up, besieged. We're going to be talking about the years stretching from the Yalta Conference of the Allies to the Berlin Airlift, and the successful effort, eventually successful, to frustrate the Soviets in their attempt to pull as much of Europe as possible into their grip. Giles Milton joins with us again now. Milton is the internationally best-selling author of 11 works of narrative history. His book, Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, is being made into a major TV series. And previously, we had a chance to visit with him about his book, Samurai William, the Englishman Who Opened Japan. His newest book, titled Checkmate in Berlin, The Cold War Showdown That Shaped the World. Giles Milton, welcome back to our show.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's great to be back.
So did I get it right? We're going to go from Yalta to the airlift. That's what, about 4 years' time or so?
Yeah, it's basically what I cover in my book is from 1945 to 1949. And it really all begins with the Yalta Conference, where, of course, the big three, Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin, sit down and try and really thrash out a new world order. The war's almost at an end. They know they're going to win. And now they've got to kind of carve up the spoils, basically. And that's precisely what they do. And a lot of it is a lot of the debate, the discussions about what on earth do they do with Germany and with Berlin.
Now, I don't want to just tell the story, but this much I think I can say, that it seems like Truman and Churchill at the front end of this story are maybe a little bit naive, thinking that the Soviets are going to play fairly with us.
Yeah. So, of course, Yalta, Roosevelt was still alive at that point, but he was very, very ill. And Stalin proved a very brilliant negotiator. He basically he set out to control much of Central and Eastern Europe. And he was in a very powerful situation by the beginning of 1945, because the Red Army, the Soviet Army, was already in possession of huge chunks of Europe. So it's sort of like a fait accompli. He'd already got what he wanted. And this left Churchill and Roosevelt, and then later Truman, in a very weak bargaining position. It was almost like Stalin had won the peace already.
Now, I have met people who were living in Berlin during that time. They were young people, and they remember quite well that the Soviet soldiers coming to town weren't polite. I'll just put it that way. What can you tell us about the Soviet approach to Berlin, the way the people were treated there?
Yeah, that's an understatement. Really is. What happened? The Soviet army was the first into Berlin. You've got to remember the Allies, the Brits and the Americans were still several hundred miles away from Berlin when the Soviets got into the city. So they had the place to themselves and they literally ransacked the place. They looted everything. They looted all the museums. And sadly, they also behaved appallingly to the women of Berlin, countless numbers of whom were raped and abused by these unruly, drunken Soviet soldiers. So it was a time of absolute nightmare and horror for the people living in Berlin, just recently liberated by this marauding army. And they were really desperate for the Americans and the Brits to arrive. And they thought that that would some sort of stability would happen when the Western allies got into the city.
Now, of course, the geography here is crucial, and it's kind of a strange delineation here where you've got a country that is already divided up on paper between the four occupying forces, but the capital city is deep within that Soviet sector. And so the city itself is going to be divided into four different directions and the country too, but you've got an island out there.
This is an absolutely crucial fact, yeah. So Germany, the Allies have agreed they're going to split Germany into four constituent parts, and each of the victors, the Americans, the Brits, the French, and the Soviets, are all going to get one bit of Germany. And they decide to do exactly the same thing for Berlin. But like you say, if you look at a map, Berlin sits fairly and squarely in the Soviet sector of occupied Germany, which means that the Western Allies are going to be in a city which is entirely surrounded by territory controlled by Stalin's troops. Now, as long as the wartime alliance holds together, everyone thinks this is going to be okay, they're going to manage this. But already some of them are thinking, but hold on a minute, if things go wrong, if relations turn sour, we've got a real problem because we could end up with our garrison troops completely marooned, isolated, if you like, inside Berlin, deep inside the Soviet sector. And they already are beginning to worry that this is a potential nightmare in the making.
And this is a point not lost on the Soviets. They know that there's a great vulnerability. I mean, if you want to lay siege to a city, it helps if that city is already far away from help.
That's right. And look, I mean, as I said, Stalin's already controlling much of Central and Eastern Europe, and he really, really wants to get his hands on the whole of Germany and also on the prize, the great prize, which is, of course, Berlin, Hitler's shattered capital. So his goal, unstated, of course, at this time, is to kick out the Americans and Brits from Berlin, take over the capital, and then also try and take over the rest of Germany as well. So there is a huge amount at stake here. It's really who is going to be the dominant power in Europe in the post-war period. So there's such a lot at stake here, and the Americans and the British are fully aware of this.
So before we get to the shift in diplomacy where the allies, England, United States, France, come to their senses and realize that they no longer have an ally in the Soviet Union. Before we get to that diplomatic story, just talk about the way the city's being managed under this commandant system and who the people were. There's a couple of very colorful figures, particularly, I guess, Howley is his name. How the city is being ruled by military commandants.
Yeah, so it's been decided that, as I say, the city is going to be in four separate parts, and each of those parts is going to have its own military commander to look after the hundreds of thousands of people that live in those individual sectors. But they also realize they need to have some sort of body that can govern the city as a whole. And this body is to be called, it's got a slightly strange name, it's to be called the Kommandatura. And the four military commandants, American, British, French, and Soviet, are going to meet in this Kommandatura to try and thrash out problems that affect the city as a whole. From this, what this means really is from day one, you have this bear pit, this wrangling that begins inside the Kommandatura, where the four commandants basically are at war, or rather, three of them, the three Western allies, are at war with their Soviet counterpart. And it's this fantastic sort of titanic clash of personalities that is going to really affect the outcome of the city and what's going to happen, over the years to come.
Who is Howlin' Mad Frank Howley then?
Yeah, so the American commandant is this unbelievably colourful kind of cowboy, really. He's called Colonel Frank Howling Mad Howley. And he's been, during the war, he's been in charge of logistics and supply. He's an absolutely brilliant organiser, partly because Howling Mad Howley doesn't believe in any red tape, any rules, unless they're his own. He does things as he sees they should be done. So he's parachuted in quite early on into Berlin to run the American sector. And unlike, you know, the powers in Washington, Truman and all his advisors, who are desperate to keep up an alliance with Stalin, Howley realizes from the moment he arrives in Berlin that it's impossible to do business with the Soviets, that they are not friendly allies. He says in his diary, "I went into Berlin thinking that the Germans were the enemy." He said, I very quickly realized that actually it was the Russians who were our enemy. And so from day one, from the moment he arrives in the German capital, he's at war with his Soviet opposite number.
So he's an important guy, but in terms of his position within the United States of America, he's kind of like the dog's tail. And does he try to wag the dog? Does he try to influence his superiors and say, look, we have a problem?
So this is what's so fascinating about Colonel Frank Howley, who, it has to be said, has been pretty much forgotten about. He's very little written about, very little known in America. People might have heard of General Lucius Clay, who is the military governor of the whole of Germany. But Frank Howley was the man on the ground in Berlin, and he played an absolutely decisive role. He was very outspoken. The Soviets hated him. They called him the gangster. They called him the Beast of Berlin, titles that Frank Howley, it should be said, absolutely loved. Yes, you're absolutely right. What he tried to do was change policy in Washington. He thought Truman and his advisors had got it wrong. Now, for the first couple of years, they refused to accept what Howley was saying. But eventually, and this is where the sort of great turning point in not only in the narrative of my book, but in the whole of post-war foreign policy comes about, really because of everything that Frank Howley is arguing about and doing inside Berlin.
So you say that this this place where the four military figures meet together in Berlin, there's that room. It can still be visited today. I don't know if it's a museum, but it's kind of intact the way it used to be.
So here's what was amazing. When I was researching the book, I went off to Berlin, obviously, and I went to the building. It's now the headquarters of the Berlin University. And I pushed open the door. It was open. So I went inside, and eventually someone came up and said, you know, what do you want? And I said, well, I'm looking for the room where basically the future of post-war Europe was decided inside the Kommandantura. And this chap said to me, he said, well, come upstairs, come up to the first floor. And he took me inside the room, and it is exactly as it was in 1945. The same table, the same chandeliers, the same chairs. And I was standing inside this room where history, big history, was made. It was absolutely wonderful, you know, just to be there and soak up the atmosphere of the place.
Do you suppose that's the very room where Howley said you can't kick a lady when she's down? I want to hear that story.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So this is, as I said, they were arguing constantly in this room. And one of the arguments, one of the very first arguments they have is that they all agree that Berliners need to be put on rations because there's very, very little food in the city. But there's a huge argument about who gets the most rations. Howley argues quite justifiably, really, that it's the old, the sick and the infirm who should get the most rations. No, no, says his Soviet opposite number. No, they say it should go to the political classes, to journalists, to influencers. And Howley turns to his Soviet counterpart and he says, but hold on a minute, you can't kick an old lady when she's down. And his Soviet counterpart turns to him with a smile and says, my dear Colonel Howley, that's exactly when you should kick them.
Yeah. How do you find that story out? That's horrific.
It's pretty shocking, isn't it? But that gives you some flavor of the sort of clash that these four men are going to have inside this room. Of course, everything is being conducted through interpreters. I mean, it's incredibly difficult to do business when you're speaking three different languages, you know, American, French and Russian. and they disagree on absolutely everything. So it should be said that Howley is the most argumentative, the most combative, if you like. The British commandant is this rather wonderful, eccentric product of British India, of the Raj, who's called Brigadier Robert Looney Hind. And he's scrupulously fair. He wants to run his sector of Berlin. Rather, it's almost like he's the umpire of a cricket match. He's so fair-minded and wants to do everything, you know, absolutely as it should be done, old boy, you know. And Colonel Howley can hardly believe, you know, this British brigadier who's his ally, you know. But actually, these two men, although they are chalk and cheese, they're completely different characters. They get on incredibly well. They bond over lots of alcohol and lots of banqueting that's going on. And they both realise that their big enemy is a chap on the other side of the table, General Alexander Kotikov, the commandant of the Soviet sector.
So it seems from your story that no matter what they're doing in Berlin, it takes a defector, a Soviet defector, on the other side of the Atlantic to finally bring Washington around.
Yeah, there were three major things that happen in 1946. And I think some of your listeners will be aware that Winston Churchill, who was no longer prime minister at this time, he came to Fulton, Missouri, to Truman's hometown to deliver his famous Iron Curtain speech. This is where Churchill set out the fact that the wartime alliance with the Soviet Union was at an end, and they were no longer the allies, they were now the enemy, just like Colonel Howley is arguing inside Berlin. A second thing that happens in 1946 is, as you say, a Soviet defector, Igor Guzenko. He defects from the Soviet embassy in Canada, and he defects with 100 startling documents that show that the Soviet Union have been hacking into the American and the British nuclear program, developing the nuclear bomb. And this causes outrage in Washington and in London, where they had no idea that Stalin's agents were eavesdropping on absolutely everything they were doing on their nuclear program. And one other thing, which maybe some of your listeners will be familiar with, is George Kennan, the famous American diplomat in Moscow, wrote his long telegram setting out and arguing that there has to be a change of foreign policy in Washington because the Soviets can no longer be trusted. These three things, Truman takes them very, very seriously and realizes there has to be a massive, total change in American foreign policy.
We are going to get to the story of what happens in Berlin to try to persuade the citizenry there that they should line up on one side or the other of this emerging divide between East and West. We're also going to fold in the story of an orchestra conductor who becomes something of a pawn of the Soviets, a famed man by the name of Wilhelm Furtwängler. That story coming up after a short break here on our show. We're visiting with Giles Milton about his book Checkmate in Berlin, the Cold War showdown that shaped the world. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. Giles Milton is with us, well-known author, in his latest book titled Checkmate in Berlin, the Cold War Showdown that Shaped the World. And this is the story at the front end of the Cold War, after World War II. And how do things fall apart in such a way that the former allies divide between the Soviets on the one side and the French, the British, and the Americans on the other? Back in Berlin, these abused people, their homes, their museums, their institutions ransacked by the Soviet army coming in, there can't be a whole lot of goodwill toward the Soviets at that point. But still, there seems to be a propaganda campaign on both sides that's mounted to try to win over the hearts and minds and the feelings of the Berliners.
That's absolutely right. And it's a fascinating story of really a battle to win over, yeah, like you say, Berliners. So the Soviets, when they come in, they've behaved appallingly. You know, they're not exactly well viewed by the Berliners, but they make a massive effort to try and win over the hearts and minds. They send in a brilliant propaganda team. And one of the first things they do is they try and bring back the most famous Berliner of them all. Of course, you'll know that Berlin is famous for his classical music, and no one at this period was more famous than the conductor Wilhelm Furtwängler. He was the most famous conductor in the world. In fact, he'd been offered the position of running the New York Philharmonic. He'd turned it down, and he'd been head of the Berlin Philharmonic. Now, he was not in Berlin at the end of the war, and he was under something of a shadow because he'd conducted orchestras for Adolf Hitler, which went down pretty badly with all of the occupying powers. However, the Soviets realized that this man was a hero to many Berliners, and they decided to give him a clean slate, to bring him back into the city and get him conducting again. And this was their masterstroke. And it was a brilliant propaganda coup. And it left the Americans and the British sort of outraged, not only that the Soviets had done this, but they felt that they'd missed a trick and that they should have been the ones seen to be bringing this hero of Berlin back into the city.
Another means of persuasion had to do with passing around cigarettes and I don't know, shoes for kids and things like that. Tell us more about the persuasion. This, and I think this was connected with an election.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, this was a city in chaos, in ruins, with the economy was totally shattered and everything was running on the black market. And of course, the British and the American soldiers, they had access to unlimited cigarettes and food and everything, supplies. And this made them kind of lords of all they surveyed. And I write about this quite a lot in the book because I found it absolutely fascinating how they, while Berliners were starving and in desperate situations, the Western troops that were inside the city, they could do what they wanted. They could, you know, sleep with any women they wanted because they had access to unlimited food, which the Berlin women desperately needed. And so you have this peculiar sort of situation where you have on the one hand a population that's starving, and then you have the garrison troops who are behaving like millionaires, buying up, you know, they're buying up everything on the black market. A sort of fabulous scene of crime and corruption and underworld that is thriving. And that's a whole sort of side of the book, which I found fascinating as well.
I don't know that there's a way to go from something like what you've been talking about to something as banal as a bad hair day, but somewhere in this story there's a very bad hair day for some functionary. Pink hair, what's the story there?
This is a brilliant story. There, there's a meeting of foreign ministers and diplomats in Moscow, and one of the American diplomats goes off to his barber in Moscow, his hair guy, to have his hair tinted, which he thinks will be tinted dark brown. But when he looks in the mirror, he realizes that his hair has been tinted bright pink, and it is to remain bright pink for the remainder of that diplomatic conference. And it was one of the sort of rare moments of humour in what was to prove an otherwise desperate battle of wits between the diplomats. A wonderful little vignette of a story.
There's so much that happens in these just 4 years of time. And the stories of near starvation and suffering are just hard. And I would imagine that in some ways life has to proceed as normally as possible. But nothing's normal in this city. And then that brings us to eventually to the airlift. And this has got to be one of the most Herculean efforts with logistics beyond comprehension.
It's absolutely extraordinary. So what happens in 1948 is what the Americans and British have feared might happen, and that is that the Soviets blocked all access to the western sectors of Berlin. They cut the rail link, they cut the road link, and this left the garrisons stranded in West Berlin, and it also left the Americans and British with 2.5 million Berliners to feed, and there is no food inside the city. What are they going to do? They have two options. Either they abandon Berlin, which is exactly what Stalin wants them to do, or they try and feed the city and their garrisons by air. And what begins is this most, as you say, this extraordinary operation, really nothing like it has ever been done before or since, is that they try to feed and supply Berlin their western sectors of Berlin using only the air. Now, you've got to remember, Berlin needs a minimum of about 4,500 to 5,000 tons of supplies every single day to keep the inhabitants alive. But the only planes available are the Dakotas at this time, and they can only carry 2.5 tons of supplies. So it's going to take literally thousands of planes landing every few seconds into the two airfields in Western Berlin to keep the city alive. Can it be done? This is to be the great challenge of the spring and summer of 1948. Can the Western powers keep the city alive by air alone?
And I understand it's all worked out mathematically on paper before it really even is sold to the authorities to make it happen.
Yeah, there was this fantastically eccentric British, he'd have to be British, wouldn't he, if he's eccentric, I think, British mathematician who sat down with his slide rule and his, you know, equation tables and everything. And he worked out that it was just about feasible to feed 2.5 million people using two airstrips inside West Berlin and the five available airstrips in Western Germany to bring in absolutely everything that was needed for the city. He went to the British commander and said, look, I think we can do it. The British commander said, don't be ridiculous. It's impossible. He then went to the Americans and the Americans looked at his plan and they said, hey, you know what? We're going to give this a go. And thus begins the Berlin airlift. And I've got to tell you, when you read it, it's like it's really sort of quite moving to read what happens, because both the Americans and the British, they bring in planes from everywhere around the world, around the globe. So the Americans bring in planes from Hawaii, from Honolulu, from Alaska, from absolutely everywhere, bring them into to Western Germany. The Brits, likewise, they bring them from all their, you know, imperial possessions around the globe, from India, from Burma, wherever. They bring their planes in. And thus they launched this operation to try and save the lives of 2.5 million Berliners. But remember, there's much more than just keeping those Berliners alive. This is about the future of Western Europe and who is going to control really the whole of Europe in the post-war period. So it's an absolutely crucial sort of geopolitical battle taking place here.
I know airplanes are being used for this, but doesn't this strike you as almost a medieval scenario with a city under siege?
You know, when I was writing about it and researching, it really struck me that it was very similar to like a medieval castle, you know, where they'd be under siege and they'd pull up the drawbridges and they'd be inside their castle with limited and dwindling supplies. It was a very, very similar situation in Berlin. But the Berliners were very lucky in they had won this. I don't know if he's famous in America, but General Tunnage Tunner, he was known. Now, General Tunner, during the Second World War, he'd been in charge of flying in explosives and weaponry to the Chinese over the Himalayas, over the hump, as it was called. And he was an absolute expert at airlifts. He knew how to get supplies into very, very difficult places. And General Tunner was put in charge of running the Berlin airlift. And he really sets up this operation that is going to run like clockwork. In fact, it has to run like clockwork, because unless you land a plane every 90 seconds into both of the airstrips in West Berlin, the city is going to starve. So it's a pretty tall order, but General Tunner is determined it's going to work, and he sets up this incredible regime, basically, to bring in food and fuel into the city. And really, I set out in the book exactly how it's done, but it's a pretty amazing operation. Nothing like this has ever been done in history before.
And you've informed me that Tunner, this guy had some experience doing a smaller airlift, but this is really interesting. Over the Himalayas?
This was over the Himalayas into China. He was running guns into the forces of Chiang Kai-shek in China. But, you know, that was, I mean, it was a big operation at the time, but Berlin dwarfed it completely, because Berlin was just on an altogether different scale. And you know, the stakes, as I say, were very high. Either the city would starve, or, you know, the West were going to lose Berlin and possibly lose Germany as well. And who knows what would have happened if Stalin had got control of Germany. So there is a lot hanging on General Tunner. And it should be, you know, it's worth pointing out that Berlin, it was feasible to do this in the summer months, but Berlin in winter, it's cold, it gets a lot of snow, and even more difficult and dangerous is it's very often fog bound. And so by the time November, December comes around, they can't land planes every 90 seconds. Some days there are no planes getting in at all. The city's on the brink of starvation. And it's really touch and go as to whether they can keep the Berlin airlift going through those tough winter months.
This is a time in the history of this region when the Allied forces institute some kinds of processes of denazification, where you have to take people who were formerly loyal to Hitler and somehow bring them around to thinking in a new way. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is because one of the most extraordinary stories you tell has to do with a former general of the Luftwaffe who is quickly, I don't know, he's enlisted to assist with the airlift.
Yeah, this is an extraordinary story. The as you say, the idea is anyone who's had any links to the former Nazi regime is considered, you know, they're not to be employed and they have to go through this denazification process. But some Germans were needed because they had skills and they had expertise, which both the Americans and the British needed. And one of them was this highly decorated Luftwaffe general who'd been involved in the battle for Stalingrad, you know, that great struggle against the Soviet forces in Stalingrad. He'd survived. He got out alive. And General Tunner, running the airlift, he needs German engineers to basically mend the planes. These planes are taking a hell of a pounding, you know, going into Berlin. They're flying around the clock. They're getting beaten up. And he needs these German technicians. So he actually offers a job to this highly decorated ex-Nazi Luftwaffe commander to mend the planes. And that thus begins one of the more bizarre Allied partnerships in the post-war period, where you have this Luftwaffe general working on behalf of the Americans and working very hard and managing to keep these planes in the air and therefore keep Berlin alive.
A big question. Let's go up, you know, 60,000 feet in the air and look down at the whole situation over these 4 years. I'm just curious about your opinion on how is it that over this time, hostilities don't break out. And I should probably qualify that because there is the story of, I guess, a Soviet tower that is dynamited at some point. But that's not, you know, trench warfare against one side against the other. How do they keep a lid on things?
You know, I think Europe was on the brink of World War III. In fact, the British commandant actually said, he quoted in his diary, he says, "One step wrong now and it's World War III." The world, it seems extraordinary now to think of this because, you know, this is only a few years after the end of the Second World War and people are already talking about World War III. And one of the ideas to supply the people of Berlin with food and fuel, instead of doing it by air, was to force a kind of massive military, a regiment through Soviet-controlled territory and basically force a passage through to the western sectors of Berlin. But Truman really worried that if they did this, they would end up, that it would be the beginning, like a declaration of war, even though one could consider what the Soviets had done as a declaration of war. But I think the world was on the brink. It really was within a whisker of World War III breaking out. And it was, everyone was very aware of this. And I think everyone was, it was so close, but it just didn't get that final nudge into warfare, thank goodness.
So was the airlift then calculated? Yes, a humanitarian need there, but was it also calculated to just go on? I mean, that's a costly and dangerous proposition to do that whole thing. But was it calculated to sort of fatigue the Soviets into standing down?
I think the Western powers, particularly the Americans and British, who really acted together in Berlin, the French often acted slightly differently, but the Americans and British, they realized that they had to stand by Berliners. These are the citizens of West Berlin who wanted to live, you know, having lived through 12 years of a Nazi Germany, they wanted to live in a democratically run city and country. And the Western powers had promised to do that. If the Western powers had backed down in, you know, at any point from between 1945 and 1949, I don't know. It would have been such a loss of face. And what after all, were they fighting for in the Second World War? I think they had no option. And don't forget, they were backed up by the famous mayor of Berlin, Ernst Reuter, who's promised the citizens of Berlin, as Frank Cowley, Colonel Frank Cowley had said, that the Western powers would never abandon Berlin. And so it was a question of really, in a way, of pride on the part of the Western powers. They simply could not be seen to back down in the face of Stalin's aggression.
The Soviets even looked at that compassionate economic program called the Marshall Plan and saw that as synonymous with a declaration of war.
They did. In fact, that's absolutely true. That the Marshall Plan originally, I mean, George Marshall offered to extend the Marshall Plan into Central and Eastern Europe. And Stalin, which by now was in control of Eastern Central Europe, didn't want to have anything to do with it. And indeed, he saw Marshall's plan to regenerate Europe, basically to rebuild Europe and rebuild the economies of Europe. He saw this as a declaration of war. He saw it as as America stepping into Western Europe and having a dominant role in Western Europe. And I suppose, in a way, Stalin was right that this was the point at which Europe split into two factions. It really was the sort of starting gun for the Cold War. This was the point at which irrevocably Europe split into two parts. You have the Soviet-dominated East and the American and Western-dominated West of Europe.
Is there a moment or an event when the Allies, the French, the British, the Americans, can say, maybe even exhaling a sigh of relief, we've prevailed, we've got the upper hand now, we can feel secure that the Soviets will back off? I mean, you've got this title, checkmate, in Berlin. I'm just wondering if the checkmate comes at a moment.
Well, you know, I think there is a specific day, you can say, which is Easter Day in 1949, where the Americans and British try to fly in more supplies than they'd ever done before. Remember, the city needs a minimum of 4,500 tons. By Easter Day, 1949, they're flying in 12,500 tons. And this is the point at which Stalin realizes he's lost. He's lost the battle to try and take over the western sectors of Berlin. And quietly, in the corridors of power in Washington, Soviet diplomats begin talking to American diplomats about the idea of perhaps calling off the blockade of the western sectors. And so this is really the beginning of the end of the western of the blockade of West Berlin. And Stalin basically steps down. He knows he's lost and he wants to call off the blockade. And gradually the airlift will be wound down and the Brits and Americans will be allowed access back into Berlin using those all-important road and rail links.
Yeah. Now, last of all, Giles, visiting there, did you meet people who have sharp memories of this time, this season, the whole atmosphere of surviving during this blockade?
I think they have dark memories of just the terror, the horror of the Soviet forces arriving in Berlin in May 1945. They also have good memories of when the British and Americans arrived 2 months later. They all wanted to end up in the British and American sectors of the city. Of course, many didn't. They ended up in the east of the city. But I think they are immensely grateful that for what the Americans and British did, and the French, of course, in a lesser way. They're immensely grateful, and they remain grateful to this day that the Western powers didn't abandon Berlin. And they're also, I think many of them are aware that the birth of NATO, which happened, of course, at this very time, sprung up precisely because of what had happened in Berlin, that the Western powers saw that they needed to band together and produce a block of power, pure military power, that would deter the Soviets from ever trying to do something like this again. So this is the point. This is the sort of checkmate, if you like, because the birth of NATO, it means that Stalin can no longer behave like he's done during the Berlin blockade. And this is the checkmate, if you like. This is where Europe changes, where Europe splits into two completely separate parts. And it's the beginning of the Cold War, which, as you said right at the very beginning, is going to, you know, last right the way through into the 80s.
This new account is titled Checkmate in Berlin, the Cold War Showdown that Shaped the World. The author with us, Giles Milton. Giles, thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure to be on the show.
The Berlin Wall, of course, was a symbol of the seeming permanence of the Cold War. And when it came down after 29 years, it seemed like an overnight liberation. But actually, anti-Western resolve in the city of Moscow had been eroding around the edges all through the 1980s, and nowhere was this erosion more telling than in that city's burgeoning underground rock music scene. We're going to take a look at that cultural underground when we return to Constant Wonder. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Smith. This is Constant Wonder. The abrupt appearance of the Berlin Wall symbolized that the so-called Iron Curtain really had descended in the heart of Europe after World War II. The wall itself did not launch the Cold War. We need to remember that. It really began in the late 40s. But that wall certainly made the Cold War very concrete, you could say. And the Cold War got colder. 1989, a generation later, the wall comes down. 2 years after that, the collapse of the Soviet Empire. Few things anticipated all of this, quite like the rise of rebellious rock music in the Soviet Union behind the Iron Curtain. We had a chance a while back to speak with somebody who was there, beginning as a tourist, and relations still very icy between the superpowers in 1984. Joanna Stingray traveled to Moscow to discover the rock scene there. To find it, she actually had to get rid of her Soviet handlers first. Here's part of a conversation Eric Schultzka had with Stingray.
At the time, you could only go in through in-tourists pretty much out of England, and they would just have these one-week trips, 3.5 days Moscow, 3.5 days Leningrad.
Oh, and these were where they would have a government agent basically conducting the tour.
Yes, and you were supposed to stay on the tour. You weren't supposed to go anywhere by yourself. You know, it was all scripted of what you were told and what you were shown. It was what they wanted the West to see. In Moscow, we didn't know anybody. Somebody had given me the number for the supposedly most famous underground rocker in Russia, this guy named Boris Grebenchikov, who was in Leningrad. So for the first 3.5 days, we did do all the tourist stuff. We were on the bus all day, listening to the woman, ramble on, you know, looking at it. The people looked unhappy. It just looked like a scary place. So when we then went to Leningrad, I thought, you know, I have nothing to lose. If I get kicked out of this country, there's nothing here exciting. I might as well kind of skip the tour today and go try to find this rocker guy. And we just said that I was sick, that we couldn't go. So the tour left and we snuck out of the hotel and you know, set up a meeting and ended up meeting Boris. And that changed my whole life.
All right. Tell us about that. You met him, you called him, he said, come on over, we've got a gig in our apartment this evening. Tell us how that happened. I really don't know. I'm just making all this up.
Well, nothing in Russia is that easy. He didn't have a phone, first of all, which is why I didn't believe there was rock in Russia, as any American in 1984 wouldn't believe. So I thought, how could he be a famous rocker? He doesn't even have a phone. But his cello player did, and we called. And, you know, there were no cell phones then. So we had to ask the lady that was sitting on the floor in the hotel, who at first wouldn't call, like a statue and refuses to help you. Long story short, they told us to meet them at a metro. We met them at a metro and went to Seva's apartment. That's the cello player's name. And we talked, and I brought my album cover for my EP and some of my promo shots. And I thought, they can't be rockers, but I'll meet them because they'll be so excited to meet me. How cool is it for them to meet an American rocker? So they started to listen to some of my songs, and they said, oh, it's great. And Boris thought this song, Boys, They're My Toys, sound a little punk. And I was very proud of myself. And I said, well, can I hear some of your stuff? And after they explained that they can't really record on anything but reel-to-reel, that then they copy the cassettes, I put in their cassette and started listening to one of their songs. Boris's band is called Aquarium. And the minute I started hearing the music, I realized this is real music. It was haunting, and it made me feel sad and happy at the same time. It had such power that I all of a sudden realized that he really was an artist, and I was just this silly kid pretending to be a rock and roller, and I started slumping in my chair. So that's how it started. And
what was the name of the song?
It was called Tonight. So
all right. We have a little clip from it. We're going to listen to a tiny piece of it.
Okay. известным количеством струн гает Валерус. Сегодня домой не надо...
All right. Tell us about that song. Is it the lyrics that get you? It couldn't have been. You didn't speak Russian at the time.
I didn't speak a word of Russian. And what's interesting is that, you know, every underground rocker in Russia, in fact, most of the public was affected by the Beatles. It's amazing how much the Beatles really, you know, proof that they changed the whole world. But none of them, I mean, the rockers knew English, a lot of them, but a lot of the public didn't. They were very moved and into the Beatles song. So I did not know the lyrics. It was just the whole vibe of the song. And somehow I felt how prolific the lyrics were without even understanding them. You know, sometimes it's hard to explain in words, but sometimes it's just an energy and a feeling. And it just, that song, even hearing it now when you played it, I got goosebumps.
Yeah, I figured you would. I was kind of manipulating you.
You know, it's, there's something powerful in that song. It just emotes so many different emotions all at once, and it's deep and it's dramatic.
I'm guessing that some of this was in the context of the time and the place and the room you were in and what you were feeling. I mean, some of this emotional connection would have come in the room itself, right?
No question. You know, the minute I locked eyes with Boris, you know, we're standing at a metro. There's hundreds and hundreds of people coming out. It's cold. They're in tweed long coats. They're in fur hats. And I didn't know what he looked like. I, of course, had the bleached blonde hair and shaved on the sides. So I figured he'd find me. But when I locked eyes with him, and you couldn't tell he was a rock and roller, he was dressed like everybody else. But there was something in that moment that I felt this person was going to change my life. So there was a connection with him himself. And then to hear his music, you know, it was just, I don't know, it was a whole thing. It really was just fate that I was supposed to end up in that place at that time that led to everything else I did that made a little bit of a difference in the world. So I just feel very blessed that was my path.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and suggest that there's something in the Russian experience that goes back centuries and centuries of this. There's a tragedy and a certain kind of bleakness that leads to a certain deepness in the soul. We see that in their music and their literature.
Absolutely. And, you know, growing up in Los Angeles, especially in the United States, California and Los Angeles, we don't have any hardship. We don't even have the hardship of weather that people on the East Coast do. So I think hardship and difficulties in life give you layers to who you are, and it makes you deeper. And the Russians certainly have had a lot of hardship and a lot of tragedies, and they have a very deep soul. You know, as Americans, I realized this after spending a lot of time in Russia, you know, we're connected to America for the ideal that we're Americans and we all came here. But it was interesting to see that Russians are literally connected to the soil and the earth. They're so connected to Mother Russia because that's been their homeland for generations and for, you know, hundreds of years. So the whole thing to me was very exciting, and it was mesmerizing, and I was just hooked from that first moment I locked eyes with him and then heard his song.
All right. I want to move through the story quickly. We have about 10 minutes left, so I want to make sure we get through this. My understanding is that you became totally immersed in this scene, and you really just hung out with these people and then went back and forth between the States and USSR. How many times? What would you say?
You know, roughly? Again, in those days, it was difficult. You could only go on the 1 week tour. So I think in the first 2 or 3 years, maybe I was there 15 times. I tried to come home, make some money, get on another trip. I was going every 3 months. It was only in 1989 where Glasnost and everything really changed things that I could start staying there full time. But altogether, I've probably been there 40 times, maybe.
All right. So you, in 1989, things broke loose. But in the meantime, you got engaged to one of these Russian rockers. And there was quite a little kind of diplomatic kerfuffle surrounding that, right?
Yes. You know, before that, I had, as the press liked to write, smuggled out music of four of the bands and put out an album, Red Wave, four underground bands from the USSR and the States, to open people's eyes up that there actually was rock in Russia. Then they were upset about that, but I ended up signing a paper admitting that I stole the music. The musicians didn't know. I paid a penalty, and then everything was supposed to be great. And the Russians said, oh, we heard you're a musician. We want to work with you, and everything was great. I was supposed to get married. We were all ready to go, and 3 days before we were leaving, my visa was declined, and I became an enemy of the Russian state. And it did take 6 months to get back in with the help of different politicians in the American government. So it was not an easy road, but eventually
married. When you found out that your visa was declined, give me a month and a year on that.
That was in January of 87, or January, February 87. I was supposed to get married in April. I couldn't get in again. I snuck in through Finland for 7 hours in the end of July. By the beginning of August, our Secretary of State, George Shultz, had a meeting with Shevardnadze about whatever they were meeting. But Secretary of State Shultz brought up my issue and the separated list that I was on of separating people that want to get married, and then my visa got reversed. So I ended up getting married November 2nd of 1987.
All right. I want you to tell me the story about how you smuggled a guitar in from David Bowie.
So when I met Boris, he said somebody that knew Bowie had visited Russia and took Boris's music back, and supposedly Bowie liked it and said he wanted to help in some way. And so when I came home, I called, got in contact with Bowie's office, sent them more music of Boris's, and Bowie, in fact, did find the whole thing intriguing and thought Boris was incredible and offered to get him something. And their one complaint is being underground bands. They didn't care. They didn't make money, and they lived in communal flats, but they really complained about not having access or money to buy any decent musical equipment. So when I said to Boris, okay, he said, I'll buy you something. What do you want? He said, Fender Stratocaster, right out of his mouth. And I don't think he ever thought I was ever going to really come through and bring it. And on the next trip, lo and behold, I came in, and here was this amazing guitar that Bowie had bought. So it changed his life.
All right.
And from that,
there's a great part of the story, though, because you were supposed to bring that guitar back out with you.
Yes, I was. So when I brought it in, of course, Customs was thinking, why is someone coming in with a guitar? And when I'm nervous, I speak very quickly, and I started saying, oh, I'm a musician. I have to go play in Paris after, please, that's my guitar, begging because I didn't want them to take it away. So they let me keep it, but they did write specifically on my customs form every single detail about it, the serial number, everything, to make sure I took it out with me. So I thought I wasn't going to be able to leave it with Boris. And Boris, the way he is, don't worry, have some tea. He was very mellow about everything. And on the last day, I said, Boris, I'm sorry, I have to take that guitar. And he said, have some more tea. And I didn't know what to do. And at the end, these two guys that I met, African Tamura, that were artists, came in with the guitar. And I said, thanks, guys. I'm sorry. I'll try to get in another way. And I opened it up, and it looked like the exact same guitar, but it was one that they handmade and painted to be an exact copy of the real one. But, of course, it didn't work. It wasn't a real guitar. And I walked out, and Customs had no idea.
You were devious. No, they were, but you played along.
You know, when you're young and you're passionate, you can be a little stupid, but some amazing things happen because of that, I think.
Joanna Stingray, an American singer-songwriter, co-author of Red Wave, An American in the Soviet Music Underground. It's a myth that dogs do not sweat, but they do pant to dissipate body heat. We don't have to pant quite so much. We're not so hirsute. I think we're kind of lucky to be able to keep our mouths shut for the most part. We're going to open up our mouths, though, tomorrow, talking about the science of perspiration. Don't want to miss it. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.